This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8:55 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or by going to our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com. You can also listen to our live shows and listen to our past shows on iPod Ready Archive section. The People Speak is a live one-hour radio show that reaches people all over the USA, Canada, and Australia, and even as far away as the United Kingdom. Our audience can call in by phone and speak to me and our guests by dialing 415-762-1162 or calling 712-432-0075 and enter access code 318116. #. We're also excited that you can listen to us now on the smartphone, so there's no excuse in the world to hear the most fascinating people right here on the People Speak Radio. And speaking of fascinating people, John Perkins is probably one of the most interesting and enlightening person that I've ever spoken to on this show. John, at one time, was what he calls the economic hitman. He wrote a book titled The Economic Hitman, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list. He is a shaman, and right now his newest book that he has written is Hoodwinked, an economic hitman reveals why the world financial markets imploded and what we need to do to remake them. Now, if that isn't a timely book, I don't know what is. John, welcome to the show again. It's great to have you back.
Thank you, Basma. It's wonderful to be here with you again.
Wow, lots of stuff is happening here, John, the economic situation. But before we get into that, can you just give us a little, for those that don't know who you are, kind of a little history of why you called yourself the economic hitman and what was an economic hitman or still is an economic hitman?
Yes, I'd love to, Beth and I. Back in the 70s, I worked for a major consulting firm, Charles T. Main, out of Boston. We had about 2,000 employees. My official title was chief economist. I had a staff of several dozen highly skilled economists and financial experts working for me. But my real job was an economic hitman, and I was trained for this. I was interviewed. I was recruited originally by the National Security Agency, as I talk in my books. And then I was trained by a woman named Claudine, a remarkable woman who knew all my weaknesses and used them to kind of hook me into the business and explain what I'd be called upon to do. And in essence, we economic hitmen have really created the world's first truly global economy, the first one that's been created primarily not with the military, but very subtly, very sneakily through economics. We work in many ways, but perhaps the most common is that we identify a country with resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. But the money doesn't actually go to the country. Instead, it goes to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in their country, things like power plants and industrial parks that benefit a few wealthy families in the country but don't help the majority of the people who are too poor to buy electricity, don't get jobs in industrial parks because industrial parks don't hire many people. But they, the people of the country, are left holding a huge debt. They can't be repaid. They don't have the resources ever to repay these debts. So at some point we go back and say, listen, since you borrowed all this money, you can't pay your debts, give us a pound of flow, shut oil real cheap to our oil companies, or with us on critical United vote, don't have any environmental restrictions imposed on our corporations when they do take your oil or other resources. Allow us to build a military base on your soil, or soldiers deport out to Iraq or someplace. And in this, we really built this empire. And in the few cases, Bassam, when we fail, and I talk about how I failed with Jaime Roldos, the democratically elected president of Ecuador, and also Omar Torrijos of Panama. When we fail, the jackals are sent in. And these are people who either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. Both Roldos of Ecuador and Torrijos of Panama were assassinated because I was not able to corrupt them, was not able to bring them around to get them to accept these deals that would be so harmful to the countries. And that's pretty much the long and the short of what I did in general. There were a lot of variations to it, but that's sort of a generic version.
So a lot of times, oftentimes today, we hear about globalization, we hear about these global empires, the New World Order, all of these catchy phrases for this global economic empire. It's already here, isn't it, John?
It is here. There's no question. You know, we're at a time in history, I think, that's similar to when city-states became nations. Except now, the nations are losing their importance. It's the big multinational corporations that are taking over, and they really who control the system. They control essentially the CIA and the U.S. military, for that matter. They were the ones I was really working for. Officially, I was working for, you know, our contracts with my consulting firm would be for the State Department or the Treasury Department or the World Bank. But the truth of the matter is we were serving the interests of the big corporations, and this is still what goes on, and we're seeing this all over the world today. We're seeing it in Afghanistan and Honduras and so many places. And, you know, it used to be that you looked at the world as this big globe with roughly 200 countries, of which a few had a lot of power. The Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, the United States at various times. But today you might better visualize the planet as still its globe with roughly 200 countries, but these huge clouds drifting around it. These are the big corporations. And they don't adhere to any particular set of national laws. They cross all borders. They form partnerships with the Chinese and the Tibetans and the Taiwanese, with the Israelis and the Palestinians, with anyone who has resources or markets they covet.
John, let me say, and you know, obviously you're probably sounding like a pretty rough kind of guy and a pretty bad guy from everything that you've told our audience and our listeners so far. For those of you that don't know, John came out with his book, The Economic Hitman, in order to help redeem himself to mankind for the harm that he's helped perpetrate on society. But not only that, he has risked his life. This was a very dangerous mission that you went on, wasn't it, John?
Well, you know, what I did as an economic hitman wasn't usually particularly dangerous, really. I mean, if the jackals struck, they struck the leaders who didn't buy into my things. They didn't strike me. What became difficult, it was when I decided after I dropped out, after 10 years of doing this, I left the profession and decided to write about it. And I interviewed other economic hitmen and jackals, and then I get very threatening anonymous phone calls. I had a young daughter. She was born in 82. Her life was threatened. I received all kinds of threats. At the same time, I received what we call a legal bribe. The chairman of the board of Stone & Webster, a big engineering firm and consulting firm out of Boston and New York, took me out to dinner one night and he said, "Listen, you have a great resume. We'd like to hire you. We'd like to use your resume in our proposals, but we won't ask you to do any work. Just let us use your resume, and don't write that book you've been working on. You can't write that, of course, and we'll pay, but we want to pay you a consultant's retainer of $500,000. Believe me, I knew the risks of the jackals. I knew what they could do. I was scared. I was scared for my daughter. I took the bribe, and I didn't write the book. And, you know, to assuage my guilt, I have to say I used a lot of that money to help develop nonprofit organizations, which have turned into Dream. You can go to dreamchange.org or pachamama.org and see the work that we do to help many of these countries. But I didn't write the book. I assuaged my guilt. And then after 9/11, I was in the Amazon working with some of these people that I wanted to help to fight Texaco and Chevron and the oil companies there. on 9/11. I was in that area. But I came back soon after and went to Ground Zero. And as I stood there looking into that smoldering pit, I knew that I had to write this book. I had to come clean. The American people had to know what was going on, why there was so much anger in the world. This isn't to condone the mass murder that happened there, but it is to say that I knew I had to talk about my part. But this time I decided not to tell anyone I was doing it, not to interview any other economic hitmen or jackals, to write the whole book, not a proposal. Don't get an advance. Don't do anything like that. Write the whole book. And then I gave it to my agent, and he got it out to all the major publishers. And at that point, it was my best insurance policy, because the jackals know that if something happened to me then or should happen to me now, book sales will skyrocket even more. The concessions have sold over 1 million copies at this point, I believe, and it's in about 40 languages. But if something happens to me that's rather bizarre, believe me, the publishers probably be happy. It'll double, triple, or quadruple its sales overnight, and people who ordinarily wouldn't have read it suddenly will.
Suddenly will. Well, I hope they read Hoodwinked as well. I'd like to ask you, you wrote Hoodwinked. What was the reasoning behind Hoodwinked?
Well, Confessions really outlines the problems, the life that I led, and it's a quite a narrative story. Many people tell me it's written very much like a novel, and I tried to do that. I tried to make it exciting and fun to read, but it's not a novel, unfortunately. It's all true. And then Random House asked me to write a book that would talk about the recent global economic crisis from my standpoint and the real underlying causes of it. And not the immediate things that everybody has been looking at, you know, what to do about the banking industry or the insurance industry or this, the loans and so on, but the real deep underlying cause of this economic catastrophe that we find ourselves in, which are the same things that we economic hitmen fomented. I mean, we really created the crisis, and here it is upon us. So Hoodwinked is that book, and it came from an expression that Omar Torrijos told me, the president of Panama, who was later assassinated. We were standing there one time, and he said, what you're proposing to do here, he said, I'm not going to buy into your plans or your bribes here, John. Call me Juanito. This was all in Spanish. And he said, what you're proposing to do here is terribly destructive, but it's not just destructive to Panama. Ultimately, you'll find that it comes back to haunt you. It should be destructive to the United States, too. So he said, no permites que te engañan, which in Spanish and in English translates to don't allow them to hoodwink you, or don't allow yourself to be hoodwinked. And he said, you're being hoodwinked, and you're hoodwinking the rest of the world in this process of creating this predatory form of capitalism, which ultimately is going to be destructive for all of us. And so that's where I get the title of the book.
But it's
really a book more than anything, about outlining the solutions to the problems, what we all need to do to turn this around, because we've created a system that it's a failure. There's no other way to describe it, Vasima. It's a failure. We've created a system where less than 5% of the world's people live in the United States. We consume nearly 30% of the world's resources.
Mm-hmm.
While half the rest of the world is living in dire poverty, on the verge of starvation, or actually starving. That's a failure. You can't replicate that system in China or Africa or Latin America. You'd need another 5 or 6 planets without any people on them to make that happen. It's not going to happen. So we have to come up with a new system, and that's what Hoodwinked is really all about.
Well, in the book Hoodwinked, you challenge the traditional definition of capitalism. Capitalism, according to Encarta, and this is in the book, and I'm reading from Hoodwinked, capitalism, economic system in which private individuals and business firms carry on the production and exchange of goods and services through a complex network of prices and markets. Now, this is the traditional term. But then you go on to say, like every other definition I have read, this one does not indicate that capitalists must plunder resources and omit externalities from their accounting practices. What are the externalities that you talk about them omitting? And can you please show us an instance where resources were plundered Well, I can think of one right now, Iraq.
Yeah, that's being plundered in Iraq, in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Recently, in 2009, the CIA fomented a coup in Honduras that overthrew a democratically elected president there, Zelaya, because he was not allowing U.S. corporations to plunder the resources of that country. And on and on. It's going on all the time. You know, it's just recently come up that Afghanistan has all these minerals that our corporations want to plunder. It goes on and on. And now in our own country, we're certainly plundering people. We're plundering human resources as much as anything. And I think you'd have to also look at the BP thing in the Gulf as a plundering. You know, it was done solely to make profit. It's been well demonstrated that BP took a lot of shortcuts, that they could have prevented this from happening. They were plundering. And it goes on and on.
And what are the externalities that you say might be omitted?
Externalities are true costs of producing something that are not taken into account and factored into the price. So here's one example. The price of oil that we pay at the gas pump does not include the terrible destruction that's happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And actually, in Ecuador, there's a huge lawsuit, $27 billion against Texaco, now Chevron, because Chevron owns Texaco, because it dumped it. The last recording I saw was more than 300 times the amount of oil that BP has dumped into the Gulf, into the Ecuadorian Amazon, knowingly, intentionally. That wasn't even an accident. That was a policy. It's a huge cost. A lot of Ecuadorians have died as a result of that. A lot of rainforest destroyed. A huge area of rainforest has been destroyed there. And the true cost of that should be included in the price of petroleum, the cost of carbon dioxide pollution of the world from burning petroleum should be included into the cost. And when we buy clothes that are made in sweatshops, like the clothes that Nike makes in the sweatshops of Indonesia and Nicaragua and other places, there's a huge cost to human beings. They can't do this for very long. They get sick. They get crippled. They can't take care of their families. They don't get enough food. They have terrible, terrible living conditions. And there's a cost there to society. So the externalities would include the cost that you should pay to give these people decent working conditions, decent wages, health care, pensions, etc., and the cost of protecting the environment from things like what happened with BP or what happened in Ecuador. So these are real costs that are not reflected in so many of the things that you and I buy.
May I ask you, are there things that we as a community should be aware of as far as I believe, John, as I have been very seriously researching a lot of what's going on in the planet, I believe that we're currently forging new boundaries and new borders as we speak.
I believe that too, absolutely.
Where are we going with this? Where will the United States go with this? Where can they possibly go with this? They're supposed to be the world leader. So where else would we go with something with this?
Well, I think we the people have to make that decision. What do we want in our lives? And I think increasingly what we're hearing is that we want a sustainable world. We want a just and peaceful world. I have a 2.5-year-old grandson. I want a world that he will be proud to inherit. And I know that in order for him to have that world, every child growing up in Botswana and Bolivia and Indonesia and Palestine and Israel has to have that same expectation, because for the first time in history, we live on a very tiny planet. And we have to recognize that we're very interrelated. We're all integrated now. And the only way we can have homeland security in the United States is when we recognize that the whole planet is our homeland. We have to take care of all those starving children in Africa and wherever else they happen to be starving, and the abused ones, the ones that are being put into by our corporations. Mm-hmm. So we really need to move in that direction. I talk in Hoodwinked about how we must create a new economy. Our current economy is based very, very strongly in military, in creating technologies that kill people and don't bring any benefits. Even during World War II, a lot of the technologies that were created ultimately became miracle drugs like penicillin, frozen foods, new technologies that were used in cars and communications. Television came out of World War II, so much did. But today, almost all of what's going on in wars like Iraq and Afghanistan is just making technologies that destroy things. We need to move into...
I think what's happening, and I think the differences between the two wars, John, is that during that time there were new horizons of technology that were available. Right now we're looking at countries that have not even reached nearly the pinnacle of success in technological advances as the United States have. So what is it that we're going to get from them? We have no technological reason for being there. We are there to plunder them.
Yes, well, that's exactly the point I make in Hoodwink, Basima, is there's so much that needs to be done in the world. I was recently in Nicaragua with a group of philanthropic investors, people who had made a lot of money in the United States, and now we're going to Nicaragua because they wanted to help campesino farmers develop organic farming and sell it to places like Whole Foods here in the United States and be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps in the process. But we discovered that much of the agricultural lands of Nicaragua have been destroyed by the big agribusinesses, our agribusinesses, Chiquita, Dole, Kraft, Cargo. We also looked at the water in Nicaragua, the huge lakes, two that you can't even see across. Nicaragua is endowed by wonderful freshwater resources, terribly polluted, a lot of that for our industries. Mm. And it occurred to me, what if we paid the same companies or helped new entrepreneurs or paid the same companies that are currently making weapons of destruction, the military companies, the General Dynamics, the General Motors, the General Electrics, the Raytheons, what if we paid them to instead come up with ways to clean up the terribly polluted lands of Nicaragua and every other country on the planet, including our own, and the polluted
including the Gulf, as we speak.
Yeah,
there's
technology waiting to be invented to do that. And what if we took a percentage of our current military budget to pay those companies to do that? And what if we took another percentage to pay Cargo and Kraft and Chiquita and Dole and those other companies to create new methods for poor, starving farmers in Africa to produce food more efficiently and to store it and transport it on a local level more efficiently? I think there's a whole economy out there that's waiting to be developed, and it'll be a wonderful economy. We don't need to be dependent on killing people. It's telling, Bessem, I think, that there's a new...
Yeah, go right ahead.
Well, there's a new movie that just came out. I think it came out this weekend. I got a sneak preview of Oliver Stone's movie called South of the Border. And he interviews President Kirchner, former president of Argentina, who talks about a discussion he had with the second George Bush president. And Bush said to him, the United States' economy is based on war. We have to have war in order to continue to grow our economy. But we don't.
It's interesting that you mention movies. John, let me ask you something. I mean, being this international economic hitman, are movies mimicking life, or is life being created by movies?
Both. Depends on the movies. But certainly in the last few years there have been some remarkable movies that have come out to teach us. I think Oliver Stone's new one is a very fascinating one. Movies like Blood Diamond and Goodbye, Good Night, I think that was the name of it. The Al Gore's movie, movies like Crude, a lot of documentaries like that. There have been a lot of movies that are being shown that are Hollywood-style movies, too, that are really portraying some of these aspects of what's going on in the world. And I think that's so important. The Constant Gardener is another one. There's been a whole slew of them. There have been a lot of books coming out. And so some of those are really accurately portraying what's going on in the world, and some of them have won Academy Awards, like the one about the people in the ghetto in India, and the name of it slips my mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
So those really are portraying the life that's going on.
A slumlord millionaire, I think, or a millionaire slumlord.
That's it.
Or something. Yeah.
Right, that's it, yes. And But on the other hand, there's an awful lot of movies out there, too, that are just fabrications and fantasies. And I think sometimes young people grow up trying to, live that kind of life that's basically impossible to live.
I think one of the problems, and this is something that even I, oftentimes as I was angry at what was going on with these mega corporations, that these corporatocracies that have developed, is that I forgot that they're not human, John. Corporations are basically doing what a corporation is supposed to do. They make money. Whatever the cost is, that's a human factor, and that the CEOs have to. But the corporation itself is an entity that is there to make money at whatever cost.
Well, that's not necessarily true. That's kind of how many of them led us to believe. We've got to remember that corporations are all run by human beings. They basically are human beneath all that. Right. And they define what their goals are. For the first 100 years in the United States, no corporation could get a charter unless it proved that it was going to serve the public interest. And charters ran on general for 10 years. There were exceptions if you were building a bridge or something that everyone knew would take longer. But mostly after 10 years, you had to go back and prove that you had served the public interest and were going to continue to do so, or you didn't get another charter. That all changed in the late 1800s when the Supreme Court decided that corporations had the rights but not the responsibilities of individuals. But I think we could go back to something along those lines. There's no reason why we can't define corporations as being there. And to serve the stockholders, yes, you've got to give a decent rate of return to investors if you want to get investors, which are important. But that doesn't have to be the only goal, is to maximize the profits of the stockholders. That you can have many other goals. When I went to business school, I was taught that if I was a CEO, then not only should I be responsible to stockholders, but also to my customers. I should serve them very, very well, to my suppliers, and to the local community, the community where my business was located. That was an important aspect of business. That was back in the 60s I was taught that. Things changed radically in the 70s, and especially in 1980 when Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and many other world leaders adopted the principles defined by Milton Friedman, the economist from the Chicago School of Economics. And incidentally, every president of the United States, Democrat and Republican alike, has embraced the Friedman economics since then, including Obama. We need to turn that around because it's a very destructive form of capitalism, what I call predatory capitalism.
Yeah. Let me ask you something. You know, the last few days on television, we've all been listening to the new plans for helping to get out of this economic mess and regulation and deregulation and all that stuff. What is the regulation scam that you speak about?
Well, again, Milton Friedman's three basic premises, really, I mean, this is simplifying it, but the first is that the only responsibility of business is to maximize profit, regardless of the social and environmental costs. Mm-hmm. Two, businesses shouldn't be regulated, or regulation should be minimized because regulations get in the way of making profits. And three, everything should be privatized, run by private businesses, schools, jails, even now the military, which we're seeing happening in Afghanistan. And those three principles have taken us down a very dangerous course to an unstable world and an unsustainable world. And so, you know, one of the big ones has been the deregulation. When I was in business school, again, in the late 60s, we were taught that we'd never have another recession or depression like the one of the 30s or like the one we've just gone through, because we had regulations that would keep that from happening, and it was true. But after that, they were all dropped over time. And Glass-Steagall is the one everybody hears about under the Clinton administration. But many other regulations were dropped that had been there to protect us. And the reason they were dropped is because corporations didn't like them. And corporations gained increasing control over Congress.
Let me give you my take on capitalism. And I am a very grassroots kind of person, and I do understand the nature of, I hear a lot of people talking about socialism. My personal take on this is that if capitalism is followed to the nth degree, the only alternative left for the common man that has not made it up this corporate ladder is socialism. And what I mean by that, John, if let's take Detroit. I live in Michigan, and we know how hard hit Detroit has been. All of the majority of our manufacturing have left the state. We have unbelievable unemployment now. And we have whole communities that were sustaining themselves on the automobile industry that no longer exists. If they are either going to, once the benefits and any kind of entitlement processes end for them, what will they do? They will have to come together in urban style societies to sustain themselves. The chances are likely that they're never going to get into a corporate situation. The average Joe that's only worked in a factory all of his life is not going to be able to sustain himself. So they're going to come together doing things like urban gardening, doing things like that. To me, according to capitalism, if we keep following it that way, socialism is the only outcome. Unless we break down economies like we have been doing and reestablish greater economies in developed areas.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, socialism and capitalism are not exclusive, mutually exclusive.
No, I agree.
I think, you know, I've thought a lot about this. I think if I had to define myself, and I don't like to do this in a political economic arena, I call myself a social democrat mm-hmm. who believes in capitalism. And, you know, there's many capitalist countries that have quite socialized systems, so for example, Canada. In fact, huge parts of our country are socialized. A couple of nights ago, I was having dinner with somebody who's been retired from very high up position in the U.S. Navy. And he was laughing. He said, you know, the Navy is the U.S. military is socialized. We get great pensions. We get great insurance. We get great health care. We had everything taken care of. We didn't get as good salaries as we might have in the outside world. This man was a surgeon, so I could have made a lot more money in private practice, but I wouldn't have got the insurance, I wouldn't have got the retirement, I wouldn't have got taken care of. The military is socialized. Our Congress is socialized. They get tremendous health care systems and benefits. So we have aspects of our economy, even though they're capitalistic, are very socialized. In many countries, have combined capitalism and socialism successfully. So they're not exclusive, and we need a lot more socialism in this country. We need it in the world. But the problem is, when you mention that word, socialism, people think of, you know, Karl Marx or Stalin. Even worse, they think of Stalin. They think of
and yet they live within a combined socialist and capitalist society and don't even recognize it happening in front of them.
Well, that's the abuse of words. And the right wing in the United States has been extremely successful at abusing words, at turning words like socialism into something dirty. And, of course, how can socialism, where what you're saying is basically you're going to take care of the people. If they're sick, you're going to give them medicine.
We can't have
that. how can that be bad?
We certainly can't have that, can we? You know, John, we have a few guests. Questions that I'd like to present. Do we have a caller on the line? No, I guess we don't. Okay. Our first question is from Steve in England. And Steve asks, are you aware that the only way the World Trade Center could have fallen is by pre-planted explosives in all three buildings?
A lot of the films that indicate that, I've certainly seen that, and I'm no expert myself, and I wasn't there. I don't like to talk about things I don't feel that I'm an expert in. I feel like I'm a pretty good expert in world economics, but you know, it's really hard for me to believe the official line of the 9/11 story. I mean, how can you know just from you know, as one example, how can you believe that a guy with a walkie-talkie standing in a cave in Afghanistan executed such an amazing process? And how can you believe that the Pentagon ended up with a hole in it and never scrambled any jets to protect it and no general lost his job? or that no pictures have been produced of whatever hit the Pentagon, because there's cameras all over the Pentagon. There's so much spurious information out there, the official information. So I've seen the information. I've heard some pretty impressive engineers talk about how that had to be preset explosive. I don't know whether that's true or not. I'm not an engineer. I can't comment on that. But what I will say is it's extremely difficult to believe the official story, and to think that America has fallen for this is disturbing.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And Ray McGovern, who served as Attorney General under the Reagan administration, was on our program, and I asked him that question. I said, do you think it's possible that it could have been an inside job? And he says, I don't know. I just know that not one person in the entire administration took a dive for what happened at 9/11. One person in security, not one person in the military, not one person in the Congress, in the Senate, right up to the president. Nobody took a dive on that. Everybody got away from
history. It's unprecedented.
Now, that was hard for him to believe.
It's unprecedented. It's impossible to believe. I mean, McChrystal just lost his job because of supposedly because of an interview with Rolling Stone, and
right.
and probably there were other factors behind it. But to think that, you know, that's in Afghanistan. To think that the Pentagon had a hole put in it, and the trade towers were destroyed, and no military lifted a finger to defend either one of those. And
or the White House. I mean, the planes were flying through space over the White House. That's never been happened. That's never been allowed.
No. You know, if somebody wanders over there in a tiny Cessna, they're surrounded by F-14s and brought down. You know, not shot down, but forced to land and forced to get away from the White House. It's preposterous.
I agree that it is. We have Alice in Wyoming, John, and she says, I think John is courageous for speaking out. But I, as an individual in the USA, feel so helpless. What can I, as a housewife and mother, do to affect this economic situation in a positive way?
There's so much, Alex, that you can do, and I'd really encourage you to buy Hoodwinked, and not just because I like to sell my own books, but because it really goes into detail much more than I can in the next few minutes. But one thing, as a housewife, I think to understand that the marketplace is democratic, if we choose to make it that way. These big corporations get away with what they're getting away with because we support them by buying their stuff. And if you don't buy their stuff and you send them emails telling them why you're not buying their stuff, you will have an impact. So if enough of your listeners here send an email to Nike right now and say to Nike, listen, I'm not buying any more Nike because you have sweatshops in Indonesia. And I'm not against hiring Indonesian employees, but you should give them fair wages and good living conditions, health care, retirement benefits. So I'm not buying any more products from you until you do that. And if enough of us do that, and it doesn't take a lot, it'll turn things around. You know, we saw that we got rid of apartheid in South Africa way back when I was in college because we boycotted corporations that supported apartheid. And when I went to college in Boston, I couldn't walk beside the Charles River. It was so badly polluted. But we forced those corporations that were polluting it to clean it up. They have a lot of rivers in this country, including ones that were on fire in Ohio. And recently we've got trans fats out of foods, and we've got antibiotics out of chickens by demanding that. Now we need to ratchet this up a notch. And so, Alex, you and all the other listeners out there need to send emails to corporations and say, listen, we're not buying into this. Maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental cost. That shouldn't be your goal. Let your goal be to make profits, but only while creating a sustainable and just and peaceful world. You must commit to that, and we're going to buy from the corporations that do commit to that. And there are corporations that are out there now that are working hard toward that. And this actually it gives me an opportunity, Basima, to say if people are able to come, there's the wonderful program that we're doing in Vancouver on July 24th, excuse me, 23rd to the 27th. We'll go into a lot of details. It's called the Tipping Point 2012, the Prophecy Program, people can go to greatmysteries.org and find out more. But it's going to deal with a lot of these things, the prophecies around 2012, which really prophesies that this is the time when we can transition into a better world. And we better do it, because if we don't do it, things are going to collapse even more.
Well, I absolutely agree. And just for your information, Alice, I'm a housewife and a mother and a grandmother. And we've been doing this show for 5 years. People like John Perkins have been guests on our show not once but twice. We are so proud of what we've done, and we are spreading the message. And we not only are spreading the message, we have an oral history of everything that is being said and documented on this program so that people like you can look back and see how you can step up and do something. You can do anything if you put your mind to it, Alice.
Thank you for saying that.
And it's the truth, and I know you know that as well as I do, John. We have Gary in Louisiana. Wow, Louisiana. Hey, Gary, sorry about what's going on down there. We're facing the effects of the corporate greed in my state from the BP oil leak. Does John feel that our government was just as guilty as British Petroleum?
Yes, and by that I don't just mean the Obama administration by any means. It's our whole government. It's our congressmen, House of Representatives and senators, and including at the local level and the national level, who've been bought out essentially by corporations. You know, BP got away with murder, literally, and destroying a huge economy on top of it all. And it's even possible, you know, this isn't likely, but it's possible that they can never stop that oil flow. It will destroy the oceans. And this is a possibility, remote.
Absolutely.
But think of that. And, you know, our government should protect us from those kinds of eventualities. Our government can't protect us from a meteorite hitting us or a huge earthquake that causes devastation, but it can protect us from corporations that are out of control. And so it has to take a huge amount of the responsibility, but so do we as individuals and consumers. Because let's face it, whenever the price of oil goes up too high, we scream and shout, bring it down. Price of oil should be a lot higher, taking into account these externalities. And some of that money should go to helping corporations that do it for oil to make sure that they take plenty of time to do the drilling and to make sure that they have everything in place to do the protection of the areas that they're drilling in, and to pay government officials to really watch out for this and take care of it. And I have to say, and I feel so moved and so sorry for the people of Louisiana and all those states. I live in Florida, and Florida's being impacted now. It's a terrible, terrible situation. But there's one thing that I must say, and I have to be careful how I say this. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to tick anybody off. But in a way, if this oil spill had to happen, if it had to happen, I think we're blessed that it happened off the shores of the United States instead of Africa or Latin America or Indonesia, because at least it's making the headlines in a big way. I think it's going to force us all to think about this. As I mentioned earlier, there was an oil disaster in Ecuador that's, at this point, I believe, still about 300 times larger than in the Gulf. And it was not an accident. Texaco did this wantonly, knowingly that they were doing it. That should not happen. But most people in the United States have never heard of that. We don't hear the oil spills in the pipelines over the Andes or off the coast of Indonesia or in Nigeria. We just don't even hear about them. So hopefully this will serve as a wake-up call. And at the same time, of course, it's a terrible, terrible thing that the people along those shores are having to endure. And it's conceivable that this will reach the whole world at some point. Some of this oil will circle the planet. We need to look at it as a viral, mutant virus that's encompassing the planet. And it really is representative of this form of predatory capitalism that I talk about.
Oh, absolutely. And just for everybody's information, a number of years ago, I had read an article on that, the reserves of oil that lie underneath the Gulf of Mexico. The reserve itself, the one that they tapped into, that BP tapped into, has more oil there than the entire of the Middle East. Now, can you imagine how long we have been tapping into oil there? this thing could potentially be unstoppable. And that is very frightening. I'll tell you what. We have more questions here from guests. Thomas from Manchester, United Kingdom, asks, and I think this is in regards to the BP drilling, is the UK government right to cut so deep down? I think John's kind of answered part of that.
I didn't quite understand the question, actually.
Thomas is referring to the drilling so deep down under the ocean. I mean, would they have the right to do that?
Well, the United States gave them, as I understand it, the legal right to do so, which I think is a terrible mistake, without imposing on them any kind of, you know, the restrictions or making sure that there were ways to protect against this. So it appears, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, I'm probably not the wrong one to comment on this, but it appears that they had a legal right. Do they have a moral right or an ethical right? Absolutely not. But then again, it's, you know, the regulatory authorities of the United States have to take a great deal of blame for the fact that they were able to go ahead and do this.
We have another question from Kev. Doesn't say where Kev is from. Is John Perkins aware of the role the CIA had in the high gasoline prices during the 1970s?
That's a loaded question in a way. I discuss in my books a lot about how, you know, after the oil embargo in the early 70s, the Treasury Department came to me and other economic hitmen and said, listen, we can't let OPEC hold us up for ransom again like this. You've got to do something about it. And we knew that to do something about it meant to go to Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis controlled OPEC, essentially. They produced more oil than anyone else. They had a lot of power over OPEC. The House of Saud was corrupt and corruptible. So I went off to Saudi Arabia with some of my other employees, some of my people, the guys who worked for me. And to make a long story short, we ended up striking this amazing deal with the Saudis, they signed with the U.S. Treasury. The deal was that Saudi Arabia would return most of the money it made selling oil around the world to the U.S. Treasury, invested in Treasury bonds, and the interest would be used by the Treasury to hire U.S. corporations to westernize Saudi Arabia, build desalinization plants, industrial complexes, in fact, entire cities out of the desert. And another part of that deal was that Saudi Arabia would never raise the price of oil higher than what the U.S. oil companies would accept, and that they would only sell oil on the international market for dollars, which put the dollar in a very strong position, which it's been in ever since. And in return, we agreed that we would keep the House of Saud in power. And certainly the CIA has played a huge role in keeping the House of Saud in power. It's one of the reasons that the first President Bush sent the troops into Iraq. They were attacking Kuwait. We had similar agreements with Kuwait, but not quite as strong, because they hadn't agreed to the things that the Saudis had. But we were afraid that if they went into Kuwait, the next step would be Saudi Arabia. So that was part of our agreement with the House of Saud, the royal family. So the CIA involvement from that aspect has been very clear to me. I was at the bottom of a lot of that. I'm not sure if that's what the listener is referring to or not, but that certainly, yes, I was very aware of that.
Yeah, I'm not real sure either, but thank you for responding. What is mutant capitalism, John?
Well, I really think that this form of capitalism we've seen since the 70s, and particularly since 1980, when Milton Friedman was embraced by world leaders and has been ever since, as I mentioned, is mutant. Capitalism's been around for roughly 400 years. It's taken many, many forms. It's a chameleon. And this particular form is perhaps one of the most dangerous that's ever existed. And it's based on these principles I mentioned that Milton Friedman defined. And it's created an extremely unstable world and an unsustainable world, a very dangerous world and an unregulated world from an economic standpoint. And I really think it's a mutant. and it's viral in that it's spreading across the planet, and it has in very rapid ways, more than perhaps any system ever has before. And it, we mustn't put up with it. And you know, Bethany, I take great hope from the fact that we're at a remarkable time in human history. We're at a time where, for the first time, every human being on this planet is impacted by the same crises. It used to be that, you know, you had hurricanes in Florida and earthquakes in Haiti and tsunamis in Indonesia. They didn't really affect other countries very much. But today we're all impacted by global warming and resources that are that are diminishing at accelerating rates, and the prices of essentials like food and fuel that are accelerating at increasing rates, and overpopulation, species extinction, violence across the planet that's due to desperation amongst the various sectors of our population. We're all impacted by these things, every single one of us. And for the first time in human history, we're all communicating with each other through the internet and cell phones and streaming. I mean, just look at the people. You've had these emails coming in from all over the country and Europe. We're all talking to each other. So at this remarkable time in human history, and I think it's a time when we can foment a revolution. Now, at the same time, incidentally, our world has been stolen by robber barons, what I call the corporatocracy, the people who run these big corporations. And yet, they are totally beholden to us. They only survive because we buy the goods and services. They haven't imposed any of this on us through military, at least not the majority of us. The military has certainly gone in places where everything else failed, the jackals and the economic hitmen like Iraq and Afghanistan. But for the most part, none of us is being forced to buy from these corporations. So we're at this time in history that I think is remarkable. And I think we're ready for a revolution. We're seeing a revolution happen in many countries in Latin America against the corporations, where presidents who have been democratically elected are saying, we're not going to put up with exploitation anymore, and we're not going to pay off the loans you say you owe us. So things are boiling. We're seeing thousands of people take to the streets around the G20 conference, and we saw huge demonstrations over the weekend against BP. People are speaking up, and I'm encouraged.
Well, I am too, and I agree. It is time for a revolution. It's time to make a change and impact your society and where we're going with this. John's website, www.johnperkins.org. Yeah, you can also go and get information at dreamchange.org. And your Twitter ID, is it still @economic_hitman?
@economic_hitman, yes, and
okay.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and on my website, I would really encourage people to subscribe to a newsletter that comes out maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks. It doesn't overwhelm you, but they're interesting, and you have to subscribe on my website.
It's absolutely wonderful. I love your newsletter because it's one of the ones that I look forward to. It isn't overwhelming, but it gets right to the heart of the matter, and the book.
Thanks.
Hoodwinked, an economic hitman reveals why the world financial markets imploded and, more importantly, and what we need to do to remake them. Now, there's advice in here for everyone to follow. Excuse me. And I highly recommend it. John, I want to thank you for being, again, an incredible guest. I want to thank you for the value that you present the world. And I want to thank you for the way you've turned your life around and affected the lives of people around you. It's amazing. You're an amazing man, and I'm very proud to know you.
Thank you, Bessemer. It's my pleasure to be with you. And keep up your great work. You're a true defender of freedom of the press, and I certainly appreciate everything you're doing.
Well, we certainly are. We're working on it, that's for sure. We're going into this is our fifth year, by the way. And next week's guest is a 19-year-old Israeli student who's been jailed for refusing to serve in the IDF. Maya Wind is an incredibly brave young woman that lives in Israel and has joined a Shemintes. It's an amazing group of young people. I'm looking forward to seeing you. And again, Hoodwinked by John Perkins. Go out and get it. Find out how you can fix the world. And do it. Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone, for the show tonight. And until then, let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of death, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.